So for Christmas, we've been working through an Advent series that we're calling basically The Promises. And if you were listening carefully to what Chris and Laura read for us this morning, we've been kind of progressing each week with a different promise that God has laid out as we look at this idea of Advent. Advent, basically, when we look at the definition of the word, refers to kind of an awaiting or an expectation, but specifically, it's about something coming. And so you're anticipating, you're waiting for this event to come. I would equate it somewhat, if you remember, when we worked through the Daniel series, and we talked about the prophet Jeremiah, who was one of the contemporary prophets of that time when Daniel was in exile in Babylon, when Judah had been conquered by Babylon. They had been taken all into exile, and so they were all living in Babylon now. Daniel, at one point, it says that he was reading the scriptures, kind of looking at them and reflecting on them over and over again. And I believe that one of the passages that he was looking at was this promise that this exile would end after 70 years. And this, at the time that this was taking place, would have been right around the end of that 70 years in this advent of the return to Judah, to Jerusalem, would have been almost on the tip of his tongue. He could almost taste it, and it was coming. And so there was this expectation, there was this advent, there was this belief that in the future was coming their restoration. And so at the advent, we're looking at the coming of Christ. And with Christmas, we're anticipating. So we like to take these weeks as we anticipate the actual Christmas day and the celebration that we will have. We would like to focus on that first coming of Jesus Christ. And likewise with that, there's also the advent of his second coming. And so this is a beautiful picture. And so what we talked about the first week, Pastor Chris shared with us, was this promise of restoration. Way back, we looked at Genesis chapter 3. There's this promise, even from the fall of man, from the very beginning, there was this promise. God said, I will restore it. Okay, right from the beginning, I'm going to make it better. I'm going to fix it. You guys messed it up. I'm putting in this plan. I promise you that I'm going to provide a means for restoration. And then we talked last week, this idea, this promise of replacement. And we looked at the story of Abraham and of Isaac and how this is a magnificent picture. How in the Old Testament, God laid out, guess what? I'm going to show you this picture of how I'm going to call Abraham to sacrifice his son. And just before he does it, I'm going to make him stop, and then I'm going to provide the sacrifice. And we saw this foretold picture of a replacement. And so there was this ram caught in the thicket, and Abraham took the ram then instead of his own son and sacrificed that. And then what we see in the coming of Christ, the story of Christmas, is God then provided that replacement. So that we are not needing to die, he provided Christ to die in our place. We saw this promise of replacement. This morning, we're going to look at this promise of redemption. Redemption is an interesting word. It's one of those big words we don't oftentimes, well, what does it all mean? There's several words that are closely associated with it. And one would be to ransom. We sang that in the song, O Come Emmanuel. It's a beautiful song. O Come Emmanuel. I won't sing it for you because that would totally lose its beauty in that capacity. But you look at the words, you know, who ransomed captive Israel. Who paid? There was a payment that was made. And this morning we're going to hear about this payment that was actually made. And we're going to conclude the whole service with this verse that we find in the New Testament that talks about this payment. And this payment wasn't in gold and silver, it was in something else. And so there's this ransom, there's this payment that was paid that took Israel, which was captive, to free them. I mean, that's what we're looking at. And so when we look at the scriptures, we talked about Abraham last week, we looked at Genesis before, and then we slide in, we look at this promise that was made to Abraham. We just touched on it last week. Abraham goes up onto this mountain. He says to Abraham, Abraham, take your stuff and leave, and I'm going to just go, and I'm going to show you this land that I have for you. And so Abraham goes. This is what we find in the story of Genesis. So Abraham goes, and God takes him up onto this high place, this mountaintop, this high hill. And he says to Abraham, look out. And then he kind of lays out these boundaries. You see, look in this direction. As far as you can see right there up in that point, and then look in this direction, and as far as you can see there, all of this land I'm going to give to you. And he makes his promise to Abraham. And then he says, I'm not only going to give it to you, I'm going to give it to all of your descendants. Well, Abraham didn't have any kids, and that was kind of a problem. So God makes another promise to Abraham, says, guess what? I'm going to give you a child. And he says, wait a minute, I'm 100 years old. And he says, I know, this is kind of the joke, right? And he said, but my wife, she's 90 years old. And I know this is going to be really, really funny. And so he promises that you're going to have a kid in your old age. And they have a kid in their old age. And they actually name the child Laughter, you know, funny, because the whole story was just it was a comedy, really. And so then Isaac, and then we find Isaac has a son, Jacob, and then Jacob has a son, Joseph, and they end up, his brothers are jealous. Joseph ends up in Egypt because he's sold into slavery. I know he's like, well, where are you going with it? Here's the point. All of this took place. God ordained it all, knew what was going to happen. And what we find is, because of famine in that promised land of Abraham, all of the Israelites are brought into Egypt as a way to save them. But you find 400 years later, all of that saving is now turned into slavery. All of the Israelites are in slavery now in Egypt. And then what you find is that passage that Chris and Laura read this morning in Exodus chapter 6. And God says to Moses now, he says, guess what? I've heard their troubles. I've heard them crying out. They're in slavery. They're being oppressed. I've heard it. And you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to redeem them. That's the word that was used. I'm going to buy them back. They're God's people already. They were taken into slavery, and you know what he does? He buys them back. There's actually a payment that's made. Maybe you don't see it. When it comes to the 10 plagues, we've heard about some of those things, the 10 plagues, water turned to blood and whatnot. You come to the end of it, and then there's this command that God says to the Israelites and everyone else. He says, you know what you need to do is take the firstborn lamb, the youngest, the purest lamb that you can have, and I want you to sacrifice it, and then put your blood over the doorpost, and then the angel of death will pass over. That's the first Passover. And so there was a payment that was made, and it was a payment in blood to emphasize that covenant, because God redeemed, he bought his people back. And so they left Egypt. And we find other stories of redemption in the Bible. You find Job would be an example of it, where he loses everything and basically says, my Redeemer lives. The one who's going to buy me back still lives. There's a wonderful story. This is one of my favorites. Just so you know, I was going to talk in depth about all these stories, and Sarah said to me last night, she says, no, you don't. I said, wait, I've got three stories. And then I said, well, maybe four. Four stories. She said, no, you pick one. And so I picked one, okay? So you can thank her later. I told that to Greg Horsch this morning. He said, yeah, you could have introduced this like the first three-hour sermon we've had in a really long time. Anyway, there's another story. It's one of my favorites. It's about Hosea, a prophet of Israel. And God says to Hosea, he says, I want you to go marry this woman. He says, oh, okay. Well, there's a catch here, Hosea. She's actually a prostitute, but I want you to go marry her. It's like, well, that's kind of forbidden. I mean, I'm not supposed to do that. That's kind of defiling. He says, that doesn't matter. I got a point to make. So he sends Hosea off, and he marries this prostitute named Gomer. And in this marriage, Gomer goes back to her life of prostitution, though she's married to Hosea. And then in chapter 3 of Hosea, God does an amazing thing. He says, Hosea, guess what? I want you to go back, and these are his words, I want you to go back and buy your wife back. Okay, so Gomer is Hosea's wife. She leaves him, goes off with another man, so now she's bound to that other man. So in order for Hosea to get her back, he actually has to go and buy back that which is already his. And he paid 15 shekels of silver for her to buy her back. And God says to Hosea, I want you to do this because it's going to show my people, how I love them and how I will redeem them. It's a picture. It's like what we talked about last week. It foreshadows that which is yet to come. I remember my grandfather died. He was a dealer, antique dealer. I know you guys were thinking, what in the world? What kind of grandfather did he have? Antiques, seriously, people. Okay, so he was an antique dealer. And when he died, my grandma wasn't going to keep the store and such. And so basically they had this big auction to get rid of all of these antiques. Well, there was one item that somehow got labeled or listed in the auction that wasn't supposed to be there. And so my grandmother was just like, that's not supposed to be on there. And the auctioneer said, I'm sorry, we have to auction this off now. You know, it's already listed in there. People are coming for it. You know, we can't not have it on there. We'll get basically, you know, sued or penalized, what have you, for not having all those things that were listed in the auction available. And so my grandmother actually had to bid and buy back the item that was listed in the auction. It was hers, but she had to buy it back. That's redemption. That's paying, in a sense, a ransom for something that's already belongs to you. It doesn't really make sense, does it? I remember as a child, I was a very mean older brother, and I was a mean younger brother. But we had this policy. I don't know who made it up. It was probably me that made it up, but it stuck somehow. When my brothers left their toys outside, and I was the one that found them, I became the new owner. That was the policy. Somehow, my dad went along with this. I'm not sure. So it actually became this rule in our house that if it was left out there and someone finds it, then it belongs to them. And so I would collect these toys. I would go out looking for them. I knew my little brother especially would leave things around. And so he'd leave them out, and I would commandeer them. Now it's mine. And he'd say, well, hey, that's mine. I said, not anymore, buddy. It's mine. If you want it, you got to pay up. And he didn't have any money, and so basically what it meant is I would have him do my different jobs around the house. So you want it back? Guess what? You're taking out the garbage for this week, you know? And that's this idea of he was forced to buy something back. Well, we're going to look at this story. It's the story of Ruth in the scriptures. And maybe you're familiar with it, maybe you're not. We're going to look through this. It's an Old Testament book. It's a historical book. It takes place during the time of the judges. So this would be before King Solomon, before King David. It takes place before that. We'll look a little bit into that. But here's this idea. There's this picture of redemption. That's what this whole book is about. It's a story of redemption. So why does God have this in the Bible for us? I'm convinced it's because it paints this picture. It points to him and to who he is. And so it says, in the days of judges... In the days when the judges, we're going to look at the whole book of Ruth, but we're not going to do it verse by verse, okay? So as punishment for Sarah's advice, I was going to go verse by verse. It's like, well, we'll lengthen it up then. That's not true. Okay, so in the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. So a man from Bethlehem in Judah, and which is interesting, there's going to be a flip around here. Starts in Bethlehem, it's going to go back to Bethlehem, and that's exactly what we're looking at here when we talk about Jesus and old little town of Bethlehem, together with his wife and two sons, went to live for a while in the country of Moab. The man's name was Elimelech. His wife's name was Naomi, and the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephraites from Bethlehem. So they were from the tribe of Ephraim. Ephraim was one of the sons of Jacob, if you know your Old Testament history. And so they belong to that. Their lineage would go back to him, but they're all part of Israel. All of those 12 tribes made up the country. We'll look at that here in just a moment. They were Ephraites from Bethlehem, Judah, and they went to Moab and lived there. So there's this famine in Israel. And so basically Elimelech takes his wife, Naomi, and their two sons, and they go to Moab. Here's a picture of what we're looking at. All right. This whole region here is basically Israel. All these dotted lines, they break down into the different tribes as to what this promised land that was promised to Abraham was actually divvied up once they got there after Moses was there. This is how it was broke down. And so here is the tribe of Benjamin. There's Bethlehem right there. Here's Ephraim. So they would have originated, their family would have been Ephraimites, but they're living down here in Bethlehem, all part of Israel. Well, there's a famine in the land, and so they have to go somewhere where there's food. And so what they do is they go down here to the region of Moab. Okay? It's not part of Israel. It's close, but it's not home. Okay, here we go. So now Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died. So here you have, and obviously in this culture, the man would have been the provider, all right? And so what would happen then is if a husband died and they had sons, the sons would take over and be in charge of taking care of the mother, right? It makes sense. That should continue to exist. So boys, if your dad dies or something, take care of your mom. That's just the right thing to do, okay? Now Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons. So here you have Naomi, you've got two boys. Well, tragedy happens again. They married Moabite women. That's not the tragedy that's coming yet. One named Orpah, not to be confused with Oprah. Different people. Though I did hear a story one time that apparently Oprah, as in Winfrey, was originally supposed to be named Orpah, and they just misspelled it. Whether that's true or not, whatever the case is, but this Orpah was known in that region as a camel salesman, and she'd go, you get a camel, you get a camel, you get a camel, you get a camel. Okay. After they had lived there for about 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion also died. So there's the tragedy. So now Naomi, her husband's dead, her two sons are dead, She's left with her two daughters-in-law. So it's a house of women. And in that culture, a means of income is virtually not there. It's not present. So Naomi was left without her two sons and her husband. Jump ahead to verse 6. When Naomi heard in Moab that the Lord had come to the rescue, had come to the aid of his people by providing food. So this is back into Israel. He's heard the famine is over. He provided food for them. She and her daughters-in-law prepared to return home from there. With her two daughters-in-law, she left the place where she had been, living, and set out on the road that would take them back to the land of Judah. Then Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go back, each of you, to your mother's home. May the Lord show you kindness as you have shown kindness to your dead husbands and to me. May the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home of another husband." Then she kissed them goodbye, and they wept aloud and said to her, "We will go back with you to your people." So basically what Naomi is saying is, you guys stay here. This is your home. You're from Moab anyhow. You have connections here. I'm going back to Judah. You guys stay, in a nutshell. But Naomi said, they said, we're going to go back with you. That's what the two daughters-in-law said. "No, return home, my daughters. Why would you come with me? Am I going to have any more sons who could become your husbands?" Now, this is one of the key points in this passage and the story to understand it. So in the culture, what it would have looked like would have been, let's say in a hypothetical, that Mahlon died. Mahlon was, I believe, Ruth's husband. And Chilion and Orpah are still around. So with Mahlon dead, then Chilion would be responsible for taking care of his sister-in-law as well, who lost her husband. You follow the connection? And so because that they're still part of that family was a big deal. And in that, and for some of us, we may struggle with that with our American kind of the way we've grown up, but in this culture, that was not only appropriate, it was admirable. So that son of Naomi's would take care of his brother's wife and really take her to be one of his own in that way. And they would be bonded with family or as family that way. And so what Naomi is saying here is, what do you think? I've lost my two sons. Do you think I'm going to have another son? And then she goes on to say in this text, even if I did, would you really wait around until they were old enough to be your husband again? You know, she's just saying this isn't rational. It's not prudent. It doesn't make sense. You're better off staying here and finding another husband. So at this, they wept aloud again. Then Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth clung to her. And this is a real picture of Ruth's character. This has nothing to do with diminishing Orpah. That's not the point. But there's something different with Ruth. And look at her response. But Ruth replied, "Don't urge me to leave you or turn back from you. Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay." We use this at a lot of weddings, don't we? This is a powerful statement of, I am bonded to you, I am staying with you, your family, and you're the only family I've got left. "Where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried." That's really powerful. But the story goes on. We find it in Ruth chapter 2. And so what happens is, they go back to Bethlehem. Naomi's kind of bitter at the time. In fact, she says, "Don't call me Naomi, call me Mara," which in that tongue would have meant bitter. If you remember, again, real Old Testament history in the Exodus, as Moses is leading his people out of Egypt, they come to this water source, this pond, this pool of Mara, is what it was called, and they go to taste it, and it's like, well, the water's bitter. They throw in a stick, and it sweetens the water. Mara meant bitter. And so Naomi's basically saying, "I am so crushed, I am so down, I am so depressed, just call me bitter, because nothing goes right in my life." So the Lord bless him is how it goes on. I skipped a part. Let's back up. So while they're there in Bethlehem, it's two women. There's no man to bring in income. There's no man to provide for them. So Ruth says to Naomi, "I'm going to go out and I'm going to go to the fields. It's harvest time. I'm going to walk after the harvesters and I'm going to pick up whatever grain they leave. It's called gleaning. Okay? So I'm going to pick it up so that at least then we'll have something to eat." And Naomi says, "Hey, that's a good idea. We have this family member. His name is Boaz. Go over to him. He's at least an honest guy. Go glean from that one." All right? And so what we find then is Ruth comes back and she says, I did go, and he not only let me glean, but he filled up my bags, and they got all kinds of grain, and this Boaz started providing for them and the needs that they had. And then Naomi's response is, the Lord bless him, she said to her daughter-in-law. He has not stopped showing his kindness to the living and the dead. And then she added, that man is our close relative. He is one of our guardian redeemers. This is an interesting concept, and we don't have it much here, but it goes back to what I said a little bit earlier about a brother taking, in a way, his brother's wife to be his own, if it comes to that. But it comes out of Leviticus. I know we don't spend much time in Leviticus, but if you get a chance, read Leviticus 25. It's about this year of Jubilee. And it's a remarkable story because it's a remarkable text, because what you find in Leviticus 25 is it's all about this redemption, all about redemption, about God buying us back and the kind of the rules that he states for other people to be able to buy certain things back. I know sometimes it can be confusing, but in the end, there's this beautiful concept of the year of Jubilee. So if you've been in slavery, they come to this year. This was the Jewish law, Jewish tradition, Jewish history. If you're enslaved to another Jewish person, in this year of Jubilee, you know what happens? You're set free. I mean, it's pretty crazy when you look at it. God had all these provisions in this sense. So what it boiled down to is, if I was poor, especially if you're a woman in this context, if I'm poor and I can't afford to provide food for me and or my family, I could, in a sense, sell myself into slavery. All right, I could sell myself, whether it's to another Jew, or I could sell myself to anyone for that matter. But then there was this responsibility. And so this is what it says in Leviticus 25. If one of your fellow Israelites becomes poor and sells some of their property, even themselves to slavery, their nearest relative is, this is a kind of a law, a rule, a command. Their nearest relative is to come and redeem what they have sold. So if I can't afford to provide for my family, I can sell my cow, right? And that's going to hurt me. But I sell it because I need that money. This is a rule, a law that God had put into place. Well, if you have a brother that does that, guess what? As a brother, I'm going to go and buy that cow back. Here's your cow. It's an obligation that person would have. You know, I know it doesn't fit with our concept and what we deal with, but in this culture, this was a powerful thing. And so basically it says, if you're poor, you sell something, guess what? You have this closest relative. He's supposed to go and buy it back and give it back to you. Why? Because it points to who God is and what God does, and he redeems us. Okay, back to Ruth. We're already in chapter 3. There's only 4 chapters in Ruth. That's exciting, right? Okay. Verse 1 says, one day then, so as Ruth has been going and she's been gleaning every day, one day Ruth's mother-in-law Naomi said to her, my daughter, I must find a home for you where you will be well provided for. So now it comes to this point where Naomi realizes, all right, she's not progressing in the sense, she's not finding anyone. It's time for you, Ruth, to find a husband, okay? You're young, I'm old, it's time for you to move on in a sense with your life. And so now Boaz, with whose women you have worked, is a relative of ours. Tonight, he will be winnowing barley, and winnowing is that process where you kind of throw up the grain, you know, whether it's the stalks or it's, and the wind kind of blows away the chaff, and so you're left with just the grain. That's what they're working on here. He's going to be winnowing barley on the threshing floor. And now she says, okay, I need you to get ready for a date. Okay, we're going to go and you're going to wash up. You're going to put on some perfume. You're going to put on your best clothes. And then you're going to go down to that threshing floor where Boaz is at. Okay, she's playing a little matchmaker here. But don't let him know you are there until he has finished eating and drinking. When he lies down, note the place where he's lying. Then go uncover his feet and lie down. And we struggle with this. Like, well, that seems very inappropriate. It was actually very humble and appropriate in this context. Okay? Then lie down, and he will tell you what to do. Ruth says, I will do whatever you say. So she went down to the threshing floor and did everything her mother-in-law told her to do. When Boaz had finished eating and drinking and was in good spirits, he went over to lie down at the far end of the grain pile. Ruth approached quietly, uncovered his feet, and laid down. In the middle of the night, something startled the man, and he turned, and there was a woman lying at his feet. So understand a little bit of what this means. So here's Boaz. He's laid down for the night. He's got a blanket or whatever. She goes and she uncovers just his feet, and she lays down at his feet. Basically, it's presenting herself, I've got nothing. I fall to your feet. What will you do? Will you help me? It's a request for help. It's saying, will you help me? Will you buy me? Will you redeem me? This is a humble request. When we look at what we're talking about today with Jesus Christ as our Redeemer, we have to do the same thing. We have to recognize, Jesus, I need you. I've got nothing to offer. I lay myself at your feet. Will you redeem me? Will you save me? It's a very similar picture. Boaz says, who are you? And he says, I am your servant Ruth. And then this is the request. She says, in a sense, will you save me? Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a guardian redeemer of our family. So she's basically saying, you have a responsibility. Remember what Leviticus chapter 25 says? Remember that, Boaz? I am beseeching you, if you will, lay your garment over me. Lay it over me and redeem me. Lay it over me and say, yes, I will fulfill that responsibility that I have. Remember your responsibility to be a redeemer. I lost everything. I have nothing. Will you buy me back? I already belong to the family, but will you buy me back? His response is, the Lord bless you, my daughter. He replied, this kindness is greater than what you showed earlier. You have not run after younger men, whether rich or poor. And now, my daughter, don't be afraid. I will do all that you ask. And so what we find in this story is Boaz realizes that there's actually a closer relative than himself. And so he says to Ruth, he says, here's the deal. There's actually a closer relative, and it's his responsibility before it's my responsibility. And so he goes to this other relative and he says to him, here's the deal. You've got Naomi. Oh, yeah, we know Naomi. She was one of us. And then you have Ruth. Oh, wait, she was that Moabite. So she's not really one of us. She's only one of us through marriage. So there's prejudices included in this. And so Boaz goes to this man and says, will you redeem them? And the other kinsman redeemer said, well, yeah, I buy her back, referring to Naomi. And he says, well, guess what? Naomi also comes with this Moabite daughter-in-law. And the guy says, see, I can't do that. And his words are fascinating. He says, that might actually be a threat to my estate. That might actually cause me financial duress. That's not going to be beneficial for me. I might lose money on that deal. And Boaz responds and says, okay, I'll do it. I don't care if it costs me. I don't care if it financially hurts me. It's the right thing to do. I will buy you back. I will redeem you. And that's what we end up finding then. I lost it. How about now? Kim? Thank you. And he says, I thought, and this is where he goes to this other man, I thought I should bring this matter to your attention, this is the other kinsman redeemer, and suggest that you buy it in the presence of these seated here and in the presence of the elders of my own. If you will redeem it, do so, but if you will not, tell me so I will know. For no one has the right to do it except you. He's talking about this other guy. And I am next in line. He said, sure, I'll redeem it. And then Boaz said, on the day you bury the land from Naomi, you also acquire Ruth the Moabite, the dead man's widow, in order to maintain the name of the dead of his property. At this, the guardian redeemer said, then I can't do it. I will not redeem it because I might endanger my own estate. You redeem it yourself. I can't do it. Then Boaz announced to the elders and the people, today you are witnesses that I have bought from Naomi all the property of Elimelech, Chilion, and Mahlon. I have also acquired Ruth the Moabite, Mahlon's widow, as my wife. And then what happens is, so he takes Ruth as his wife. They actually have a child. And this is where it gets really cool and associates with Christmas so well. But it says, then Naomi took the child. This is her grandchild, grandson now, in her arms and cared for him. The women living there said, Naomi has a son. This would be a grandson, but still we look at those ancestors as the mother of and such. So Naomi has a son, and they named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. Why is that significant? Because we find remember this? This is a picture. Remember that I had this last week. All of what we've talked about points to a picture of something that is not yet seen, that is coming, that will look like the previous. Remember? There it is. Okay. Picture is pointing to something that's coming that we had not yet seen. And then when we see it, we see the similarities. Do you follow? So here's what we find in the genealogy. Salmon, that's a fishy name. The father of Boaz, whose mother was Rahab. Boaz, the father of Obed, that's the name we just saw. Boaz and Obed, whose mother was Ruth. Obed, the father of Jesse, and Jesse, the father of King David. Why? What is this? This is the genealogy of Jesus Christ. Everything that we talked about with this story of Ruth was all part of the Christmas story, thousands of years before it ever came to pass. This is Luke's version of it. The son of Melee, the son of Menah, the son of Mattatha, the son of Nathan, the son of David, the son of Jesse, the son of Obed, the son of Boaz, and the son of Salmon. Luke 1 says this, "Praise be the Lord, the God of Israel, because he has come to his people and redeemed them." You know who said that? That was Zechariah. Zechariah was the father of John the Baptist. And Elizabeth was a cousin of Mary, and they were pregnant at the same time. John the Baptist was born shortly before. And if you remember, when Mary came into the presence of Elizabeth, the baby leapt in her womb. That was John the Baptist. And Zechariah couldn't speak until he said, "His name shall be John." And this is the song that he sings after his son is born. And he says, "Praise be to the Lord, the God of Israel, because he has come to his people and redeemed them." God is in the business of redeeming us. Galatians 3, Chris and Laura read this for us this morning. Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law by becoming a curse for us. For it is written, "Cursed is everyone who is hung on a pole." Who was hung on a pole in the New Testament? Jesus. And yet he did not stay there. He redeemed us in order that the blessing given to Abraham might come to the Gentiles through Christ Jesus, so that by faith we might receive the promise of the Spirit. Titus 2, verse 13 and 14. While we wait, this is that idea of Advent, while we wait for this coming, for the blessed hope, the appearing of the glory of our great God and Savior Jesus Christ, who gave himself for us to redeem us from all the wickedness and to purify for himself a people that are his very own, eager to do what is good. 1 Corinthians 7. "Were you a slave when you were called? Don't let it trouble you. Although you can gain your freedom, do so. For the one who was a slave when called to faith in the Lord is the Lord's freed person. Similarly, the one who was free when called is Christ's slave. You were bought at a price." There was a price that was paid for you. 1 Peter chapter 1. "For you know that it was not with perishable things, such as silver or gold, that you were redeemed from the way, the empty way of life handed down to you from your ancestors, but with the precious blood of Christ, a lamb without blemish or defect." Do you understand the payment that was paid? We read in the scriptures, you know, the wages of sin is death. So in other words, there's a cost to our sin that it's expensive and you can't pay it. You can't redeem it on your own. We've looked at all of these scriptures over and over again. You can't redeem it. You can't pay it. You have no resources by which to redeem yourself. But there is a redeemer. And this whole story of Boaz and Ruth points to this fact that Ruth could not redeem herself. Naomi could not redeem herself. But there was a redeemer in Boaz that said, "Yes, I will do it, even if it costs me." And God did the same thing for us, even if it cost him, which it did cost him. It cost him everything. And I love that last passage where it says there was a payment to be paid, and that payment was not silver. The payment was not gold. The payment was paid with the blood of Christ. And we will celebrate his Advent. We will celebrate his coming. We will celebrate his coming of Christmas, and we're going to celebrate that with the receiving of communion this morning. But we will also celebrate the promise that he's coming again. We'll celebrate this fact that he gave his blood as a payment, as a ransom for us. You owe a debt. We all owe a debt that we cannot pay, and there's only one person that can pay it. Some of us have recognized that and say, "Okay, I'm broke." We laid ourselves at Christ's feet and said, "I need you to redeem me." Others of us saying, "I'm still trying to do it on my own. I'm still trying to figure things out. I think I can save it up enough and maybe make that payment." Well, it's time to stop saving and start laying ourselves down at his feet and saying, I need you to redeem me. I'm going to invite Pete and Chris up. And we're going to receive communion this morning. And the worship team, if you'd come up as well. Here's what I'd like to do. Chris and Pete are going to be on either side, and they're going to hold elements. And we're going to receive communion. But I want us to understand what it is that you're receiving. Because basically what you're being given is a payment. You're being bought back with the blood of Jesus Christ. That's huge. I mean, it's just absolutely huge. There's no words that really can describe the payment. It's like my grandmother going to this auction and being forced to buy back that which was already hers. We're his. We left. And he says, that's all right, I'll buy you back. I love you enough, and not only will I pay for you, I will pay for you with my own blood. And he gave himself so that we can be free. So as you come and you receive the cup and you receive the bread, understand that what you're holding is a symbol of that payment that he made for us. That's an expensive price.